Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Michael Joseph Mitchell, who, like Doug Jones, whose interview you heard if you were listening last week, is in three plays currently running at the Oslo Repertory Theatre. Today, we get Michael's take on what it's like to be in three very different shows. So hang on, here come the show. Is all about finding, discovering, uncovering, dissecting who you really are, and then becoming it. It is the intention of this show to point out what I believe to be the truth, based on my somewhat 30 years of practice as a psychotherapist and my personal experience in life. And that is that most of us, I would say all of us, except that I am suspicious of generalizations, have parts of ourselves, qualities, abilities, that we have hidden. Not only have we hidden them from other people, but we have hidden them from ourselves. Somehow in our lives, we got the idea that these abilities, capacities, skills, talents, instincts, behaviors, ideas were not going to work. They were not going to get us what we all want, which is to feel safe and loved. And of course, this all begins in childhood. And if you've been listening to my shows, you know that usually I spend the first part of my show talking about why this is so, how this happens to us. And many of the podcasts, although not all, that talk about those ideas, why we get stuck, how we get stuck, how we create versions of ourselves which are true but not the whole story, what I call our cover story. Anyway, those podcasts, or many of them, are up on my website, which I will remember to speak about today. The website, thelynnshow.com. thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. thelynnshow. There is another The Lynn Show. And, I mean, you could listen to her, but if you want me, you have to put in the E. And if you go there, there's a section for podcasts, so you could click on it. And if you're interested in any of those ideas, many of those podcasts are up there. I am trying to get a new web service because I just cannot do another learning curve and figure out how to do my own. I'm not going to do that in this show. I'm not going to talk about that. Because the other thing that I do in my show is I have a series called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And the reason that I do that is that it is my belief, and it has been confirmed for me over and over again as I have done these interviews, that people who are making their living or their life with an art, at least in that area of their life, are exactly who they are. You hear it over and over and over again. I couldn't do anything else. I can't imagine doing anything else. I can do a lot of other things, but none of them make me happy. Some of them make me crazy. The only thing I know how to do, the only thing I feel right doing, the only thing I want to do, the only thing I can do is this: paint, draw, sing, dance, act. So, at least in that area of their life, these people are exactly who they really are. And it is my hope that by playing these interviews, you get an opportunity to hear what it feels like when you are coming from, to use a psychological term, congruency, when you are congruent with yourself, you are in sync with yourself. Who you are, what you say, how you act, how you look, they're all real. They're not masks, right? And they aren't parts of you which you have found a way to deny. Another psychological term, denial, right? Now, it's my belief that while we, pretty much all of us, had to hide parts of ourselves from childhood on because our family didn't like them, or people made fun of us, or when we had this behavior or acted in this way, we were neglected or punished or embarrassed. So we learned that these qualities, these ways of being, did not bring us what we wanted, and we figured out how to, first of all, not do them, not be them, and over time, forget we had them. So, however important it was to do that when we learned to do it, it's my belief that these parts of ourselves, these neglected, denied, abandoned, hidden parts of ourselves, don't go away. They're still there. And many, many, many times, they become exactly what we really need, a quality we really need. So let's say you were a kind of clown as a small child. You would pratfall and do silly things. And, well, you came from a very serious family, maybe a very religious family. And one or another of your parents or aunts and uncles or grandparents or teachers or Sunday school teachers or somebody really came down hard on you for that behavior and embarrassed you or humiliated you or teased you or even punished you. So that capacity to make fun out of everything, to be silly, to find the joy, the silliness, the wonder, the delight, the absurdity, right, in the world, you found a way to hide that from yourself. But that's a wonderful quality. And the people who told you it wasn't made a mistake. And it may be that now in your life, you need some lightening. You need some joy, some silliness, some frivolity, some play, some fun. Well, it's still there. And the ability to find that, resurrect it, get it back, can be really the thing that you need in your life to make your life fulfilled, delightful, something better than it is. So you can see that it would be in your interest to discover it. But the taboo against discovering it, the memory locked in our brains that this is going to bring the wrath of something bad down on us, that's, you know, that's what stops us. So again, this show is about, first of all, recognizing that there may be parts of you that you might want that you have successfully hidden from yourself. Second, to know that that is not gone forever, that you can get it back. And third, to help you see what it looks like when you've got it. That's what these interviews are all about. And fourth, to give you some skills to help you recover it. And that's what's in a lot of those podcasts. And I will get back to doing in shows in the future. But in this show, since the interview that I'm playing with Michael Joseph Mitchell was pretty long, I'm not going to have time to give you much more information than the information I've already given you. I'm going to play Michael's interview. And as I did last week, this is something I haven't ever done before. Last week, when I played Doug Jones's interview, I played Sharon Leslie's review of two of the plays that Doug talked about. And Michael is also in those two plays, actually, in all three plays that Doug is in. They do them in Rep at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. So Michael is talking about two of the same plays, and I'm going to play the reviews again. So in the event that you didn't hear last week's show, you will hear Michael Joseph Mitchell talking about two of these shows, the ones that will still be playing, and Sharon's review, all of which I am certain will encourage you to come and see them should you be anywhere near Sarasota, Florida. So, okay, coming up now is going to be Sharon's review. I think it's of Hearts. And then my interview with Michael. And then Sharon's review of Perfume Shop. I believe that's the order I'm doing them in this show. In any case, here's Sharon's review.
Hi, this is Sharon Leslie with my review of Hearts. Ten Hut, line up outside the Oslo box office. Buy a ticket to see Hearts, one of the best recent plays about the effects of World War II on its veterans. Hearts is so good it was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, so laugh, cry, and be swept into the story of Donald Waldman, an aging World War II war veteran, as he battles his spreading waistline, plays cards with his buddies, cares for his wife and family, and tries to find ways to calm his heart and soul when his war memories invade his sleep and his life. While all this may sound like the hype you read on the back of a DVD cover, this play is actually written by a son about his father, a real son, Willie Holtzman, about his real father. Names are changed for the play, but the essence of the story is rooted in a life lived. I read the play before I saw it. I was amazed at how well it transferred to the stage. The plot line is not linear. It skips around like a person's memories. As the story unfolds between the past and the present, we learn more and more about Waldman's life and the secrets he has been keeping deep inside. While the language is colorful, it's also working class, army barrack authentic. The playwright Holtzman doesn't hold back on the less than appealing aspects of being a soldier in the trenches. Doug Jones, as Donald Waldman, almost never leaves the stage. He gives an impressive portrayal of the tormented veteran. He brings humor, pathos, and a soldier-warrior mentality to his performance. He is marvelous. The other actors on the stage create well-defined characters and all work well as an ensemble. The direction by Greg Leeming is taut and the transition smooth. He makes sure we in the audience know what is going on as it skips around. The pivotal scene in the second act, which I don't want to reveal, is haunting. The production itself has a visual theatricality that engages and sets the mood. The set by Judy Galen is multi-leveled and shaped. The set functions well through its multiple places and times. The light and sound effects give the impression of wartime battles, as well as peacetime Brooklyn. The lighting by James Sale is quite spectacular and evocative. I hope you will find a way to see Hearts. I think that seeing this story on the stage will be more effective than if it ever gets to the movies. Hearts is really, really good theater.
So I am here with Michael Joseph Mitchell in the small conference room at the Oslo Theater.
And it's not so small. It's
no, it's not. It's not. I always have to explain. I host an internet radio show, and one of the things I do on it is a series called Anatomy of an Artist, and I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm-hmm. And do you think that describes you?
In a good year, yes.
Well, even, you know, it's an interesting way to put it. And my guess is that when I say living a life, you know, that would be your choice if that were possible, right?
You betcha.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And that's what makes it, that's what makes you somebody who makes their living or their life with it, right? You
yeah.
can't always pull it off, but if that would be your choice, then that's
yeah.
right.
It's kind of, I have no choice. It's the only thing I've got that I do that I do well.
that's a common response that I get from people who, in this category. They all say that, you know. So I always start the same way. I always ask, how did this happen? How did you find it? How did it find you? How did it start? What made you know it?
The profession or this particular gig?
Oh, no, the profession.
Oh.
You're wanting to be an actor.
Let me see. You know, I hadn't actually thought about that before. A couple things, maybe. An accretion of a few little things. I mean, as young as third grade, I have very clear memories of... I remember it was also the same year I first had to start wearing glasses. I was very nearsighted and very overweight kid until I was 16. A Christmas play came up, and I was given a role of one of the Three Kings, and that made such an impression on me. I never forgot it. And then later on, in high school.
You know, I want to stop you for a second.
Yeah, please.
I don't want to run over the third grade Christmas play, because when you say it made such an impression on you,
mm-hmm.
do you have? It's clear you remember it. What was it? I mean, was it the audience? Was it the learning of the script? Was it being the character? Was it working with the other people? What do you remember?
I don't know if I can say clearly, but I have such clear pictures of it. It was. I don't know quite how to put it correctly, but it was something about being part of this presentation, this thing that was this little play that was so outside my experience and so kind of wondrous to me, even though it was silly and cute and
sad.
To me at that point, it was like, it was a mind blower. It was like, wow.
Yeah, this is a way I can be in the world. Different from the way I have been.
Let me tell you.
Yeah. I can feel it. Actually, I get tears in my eyes when you talk about it. I mean, the power of knowing finally that how I've been, which may not have been so terrific, is not the only option for me. Am I way off base here?
No, I would say you are not, because certainly the next time I was kind of dragged back into it was by a teacher from my grade school, who then moved to my high school. And I think she recognized me. She was this delightfully crazy woman named Mrs. Burke, who I think got it that I had, it's not like I didn't have friends, I had friends, but I was kind of the quintessential dorky, overweight, long, scraggly-haired kid. And she pushed me into a couple of plays. And by that time, it was my freshman year of high school, and she dragged me kicking and screaming to audition for 10 Little Indians they were putting on. After that, it was all over. I got a part in that, and that really put the nail in the coffin for me. This I can do, and this is magic to me.
Yeah, and again, it's not uncommon. It doesn't happen to everybody, but it's not uncommon to hear that there is a pivotal person mm-hmm. who says, you can do this, you should do this, this belongs to you, you belong to it. Something, you know, that... it's just not an uncommon thing. So it's interesting to hear that it was a teacher because quite often teachers are oblivious, you know, and not interested in helping a person become themselves. I mean, you know, they've got their what they're teaching or whatever, but mm-hmm. it sounds like this teacher was more interested in helping you be yourself.
Yeah, she's a pretty amazing woman. And I would say that off the top of my head, all of the pivotal people in my career/life had probably all been teachers. You know, after her, most of them were teachers of theater of one sort or the other, but
right.
all of them teachers.
Okay, so now we have you in high school in 10 Little Indians, and we have you wanting to, you know, knowing that this is a good place for you. So then what happens?
Well, then I was in every darn play that happened from then on throughout my high school career. And the fellow who was sort of my theatrical hero in high school went off to a college in Des Moines, Iowa. And, you know, while I wish I had looked around and auditioned for more schools back then, that was good enough for me. So I followed him to Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa for theater, and where I met some wonderful teachers and made some of my very best friends, you know. I could have gone to a better theater program, but I went to the one I went to, and it's all good. I really think I found my master's degree, or whatever it is you want to call it, after college by the independent teachers I found mm-hmm. after then in various cities, and moved to New York after that. And so, you know, I think as much as I felt at one point I really need a conservatory program to confer upon me whatever the stuff I feel I'm missing, and the right to call myself an artist. And one of those pivotal teachers told me, what are you talking about? You're in a professional program right now. You don't need anything. Keep finding more knowledge, but you certainly don't need to ensconce yourself in a program.
You're already what you are.
Yeah, so he was another great gift. Yeah, and then it was Drake University, and through that, the last... semester of that was spent at a program, a semester-long program that's done twice a year at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Connecticut, called the National Theater Institute, a very accelerated program where you sleep 2 hours a night, and all these big shots from New York come in and train you. And then I was lucky enough that year, after that was over, they did an exchange program with a theater in Paris that was at that time being run by the great director Patrice Charreau. And so I had some months working with some of the best people in Europe, too. I was really lucky that timed out. And then came back and banged around New York for years.
How old are you now in this part of your life?
I am currently 46.
No, I didn't.
Oh, that part?
I mean that.
Oh.
Yeah, in that part.
Well, right out of college. You know, that
yeah,
was
so
right out of college then.
23.
So, yeah, 20s into mid-30s, and spent the better part of 15 to 18 years in New York City. Loved it terribly. Got married once, unmarried once, and married again, and only left because my second wife... was also a brilliant actress, but made some real money doing event production and corporate videos and such. Was headhunted by a company in Minneapolis, so we got married in '97 and moved there. And although it's a lovely city, it was terrible for us, and we were like ready to leave. And then her company that had hired her said, "Hey, how'd you like to move to Chicago?" And we were both born in the Chicago area, so we said, yeah, so that's why I'm now based out of Chicago.
Ah!
miss living in New York terribly, but love Chicago. Great city.
Okay, so, all right, so then you wound up in Chicago.
Yep.
So how'd you get here?
A wonderful actor who I've now happy to say I've become friends with, David Breitbart, who's a company member here, got the good fortune to be cast, along with his fiancée as well, in the national tour of Spring Awakening. And he was going to be doing the track that I'm on, these three roles in these three plays. And so Michael Edwards, God bless him, came to Chicago. He may have gone to other cities, but he came to Chicago first, I think, and held auditions. My agent sent me, and I walked in the room, and he said, "Oh, look at you, you have three first names, just like me." And I said, "Oh, read Stephen Kadar first. You've got the hair for it." And, it was just probably the most lovely audition I've ever had, and those are usually horrible and filled with fear and dread.
Yes.
And I was lucky enough, he took me.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Okay, so here you are at the Oslo doing these three plays. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about the different roles.
About the roles here. Well, it's funny, I haven't mentioned this to anybody else I've talked to so far, but the biggest fun is the fact that the first one, Galileo.
Yeah, do you want to describe them all to me? Or
sure.
Yeah, right.
Well, the role in Galileo, it's actually two of them. The first one is a fellow named Sagredo, who was a historical figure and acquaintance of Galileo's. In this play, he's kind of his best friend. He's a senator in Venice, where he began his career, and also a scientist, and really understood where he was coming from. And I think his function in the play is to be the one person who really personally loves Galileo and understands the implications of what he's about to do and desperately warns him off it. And he just won't listen, of course, otherwise we wouldn't have a play. And then later on I come back as Cardinal Bellarmine, Robert Bellarmine, who was actually canonized in 1935, who is the fellow charged with warning him by the Holy Congregation that they have decided that all these teachings that come from Copernicus that he is pushing are heresy, and he better shut up. Now, he can toy with them in private, call them suppositions or something, but he can't advocate them in public. If he plays ball, they'll take good care of him.
In an ironic way, both of these characters are telling him the same thing.
And he doesn't listen to either.
You know, right.
They're just coming from two different sides.
Right, right.
You know, Sagredo being on his side, but he's seen enough that he has a fairly cynical view of humankind and Galileo's ability to freely talk about his ideas in public, and he's right.
Yeah.
Great men probably only succeed when they don't listen to anybody else, though, so there you go.
Well, that's actually, I mean, there's a lot we could say about that, but in a way, it seems to me that, you know, what you said in the beginning, actually, I don't think I even have it on tape, when you were talking about that there's nothing else you can do,
mm-hmm.
that this is what you do,
mm-hmm.
this is, you know, I would imagine that if there haven't been people, there would be people who would say to you, "This, why are you doing this when you could probably make a lot more money doing something else and not put yourself in any kind of jeopardy?" And yet, this is who you are, this is what you do. I imagine Galileo had some of that.
Yeah, it's you know, first of all, it's done so rarely, but it resonates, I think, with everybody doing it, but it certainly does with me.
the play, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, and I think it does resonate with everybody doing it, and not only everybody doing it, but you know, it's interesting, the thrust of the show that I do, the theme of the show is to help people figure out who they really are and then become it. And the reason I interview artists is because it's my belief that if you're an artist in this culture, it's because it is who you really are, at least in that area of your life, or you wouldn't do it. Nobody would choose to be an artist in this fakasha culture, you know,
yes.
That where, you know. So when I talk to artists, you can hear it. you can hear, this is who I really am. Like it, don't like it, it's the good thing, it's the bad thing. It would be my first choice. It's safe, it's not safe. I can't help it, right?
Oh, it's absolutely true. Like a, for my wife, for example, I said we met in an acting class. She is a brilliant actress. The week after we moved to Chicago, she got a leading role at the Victory Gardens Theater there. But she has these other skills that she's used, and they've managed to keep her and now both of us comfortable, but it is not easy because her soul is the soul of an artist. Now, she brings that artistic vision into the nuts and bolts work she does,
but she pays a price.
But she pays a price for it.
Right. And that's the price Galileo is not willing to pay.
Yeah. Or, you know, in a way he did by capitulating, but he still continued his work in secret anyway.
That's right. And the question is not necessarily how you demonstrate who you are in the world, but that you know who you are.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, so that's Galileo, and then...
Then the perfume shop, which, well, I guess none of us had seen because it was just translated for the first time by Miklos Hammerschmidt, the original... Miklos Hammerschmidt is the character in the play, forgive me. Miklos Laszlo, the playwright's nephew, Ed Dowdall. But it's the original source play that a million things were taken from. First the movie The Shop Around the Corner with Jimmy Stewart, and then In the Good Old Summertime with Judy Garland. And then one of my favorite musicals, She Loves Me, by Bach and Harnack. And then I wasn't even aware of this, but it's also You've Got Mail. I'd never seen that. And I love all, at least the first three of those, so much that I was thrilled to get to do this. And the character is the rotten guy, Stephen Kadar, who was played in the musical by Jack Cassidy, who's one of my favorites. And,
oh, yeah, you have the hair.
That's what Michael said to me.
Right.
You got the hair.
You do.
Even though actually in the play, you know, it's all slicked back.
Yeah, I know.
Hey, whatever gets you noticed, if it's the hair, fine. And it's just an utter delight to go in there and be the one with the secret, the one who could really care less about anybody around him, but what they can do for him. And, you know, you think he's just diffident thinks he's above everybody else, but then you realize the depth of his skullduggery as the play goes on, and he gets his comeuppance, and it's tons of fun, although it's a little disconcerting every time I hear them cheering my comeuppance. But I guess that means I've done my job.
Yes, you have. Yes, you have. If you weren't so bad, we wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't be cheering so much for everybody else who survives you, you know.
And that one's just pure fun. I mean, I think every time we all go back to it, those nights we're all like, perfume shop.
I know, and that's how everybody in the audience feels, too. I mean, it's so much fun. And I think, frankly, better than any of the things that came after it. Because it has his story, you know. Hammerschmidt's story, right? And that the other ones don't, as far as I can, you know.
Less so. I mean, the shop around the corner is pretty darn close, although they've changed some elements of the plot. But it,
the other ones are focusing so much on the romance, right?
Right.
And that, you know, you don't lose that in this one. It's there, big as life. But the other story, which is so poignant, and, you know, so you have the two masks, you know. Anyway, I really loved it. Okay, so that brings us to...
Two Hearts, which in, you know, it's like, which among your children, but in a way we all have a very strong feeling about that too. Now, I know I do. It's a play by Willie Holtzman that I was unfamiliar with, although they had done it in the Chicago area, and one of my favorite actors in the world, Mike Nussbaum, did it there, specifically about one returned World War II veteran and his journey kicking and screaming to make peace with what he lived through in the war and the effect it's had on his life since. In his case, one of the things it's done to him is that it has turned him into a compulsive eater. And his circle of friends, the three other guys who he's known since they were this big and who play cards every week, hence the name Hearts. And I'm the one who's... well, kind of referred to as, if anybody of the crew, his best friend, and the one of the four of them who's a little less cynical and is the one with, as they say, more heart.
Yes.
Whose nickname is Babe, and who also has trauma from the war expressing itself in his life. We find out that he doesn't sleep. And you know, we don't get any deeper in that because it's really Donnie's story. But for myself, of course, I had to piece together the rest of Babe's existence and what exactly did happen to him and why he doesn't sleep and all that. So
did you?
Well, everybody's got different ways of working it. None is more valid than the other. But for me, I've got to know what life I'm walking onto stage from and going back to when I go off the other side. So, especially when towards the end, he finally almost says what he did in the war and then stops himself and then looks to Donnie and says for the first time, I never told you why I don't sleep. And Donnie says, I never told you why I don't eat. And we just decide, you know what, it's okay.
And there's
so I have to know what that is for me.
Can you tell?
No, not to be too precious about it, but at least until the play's over.
Fine. It's okay, it's fine.
And it's great when you have a wonderful director like Greg, who at one point just turned to me when we were working on the scene and goes, so, do you know what happened to him in the war? And I said, yeah. He said, good, don't tell me.
That's lovely.
And specifically because he has carried it and he has not told a single soul, including his wife, that there is some advantage to truly keeping
the
some
secret.
Of those actors'
of course.
Secrets. Like
yeah,
they
no,
call
that's
them.
Absolutely right, because that's why he's not sleeping.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to be
no, no,
coy.
You're not.
But I did figure out something
that worked for you.
That is so powerful to me that I can understand why it has had this effect in his life, and why, as the lines seem to indicate, it came on after he had his own child, after he had was first a father. You know, and then things you have to build who this person he only mentions twice, Nancy, his wife is, and what their life is like. You know, I figured out what their song was. It's not only fun, but it's kind of the actor's homework because it keeps you from just being general.
Yes.
If you can be specific, if there's just something extra in the way you refer to somebody that shows they really exist for you.
Yes.
That makes the play more real for everybody else.
And it's a wonderful performance. I mean, yours. It's a wonderful performance.
Thank you.
So, and I'm thinking here. I'm trying to figure out. Don't tell me because it doesn't matter. But why finally going off to Florida would solve it for you?
I don't know that either. And I asked Greg, and he didn't know that. There's something about having taken that step that releases him. And I, to this day, I mean, you know, sometimes you figure out stuff at the last performance. And I may. And I try and make that transition.
Well, we're happy for you.
Yeah.
You know, happy for you. And I thought maybe you were going to connect them somehow.
Well, the way I've made that transition for myself is, okay, I'm getting nowhere with Donnie because I'm just announced to him that we're moving and he's upset about it. So the way I've been bridging that transition myself is, well, listen, Donnie, you know what? If you did something for yourself, it might help everything because look what happened to me. I all of a sudden can sleep now.
Yeah.
So I think I'm like trying to provide him an example.
Yeah,
that's
right.
The best I could come up
right.
with so
right,
far.
Right. No, I got it. And, you know, as his best friend, which you really are.
Uh-huh.
Which you really are. Okay, now, I have not forgotten that we started this to talk about the plays and the roles that you're playing, mm-hmm. and you said, I haven't said this to anybody.
Oh.
So what was it?
Oh, what became tons of fun is that we both realized that after I met Paul Whitworth, who was doing, you know, Galileo stunningly, and as well as Mr. Hammerschmidt in the perfume shop, and I get this glorious slice of heaven that is this 15-minute scene with him as Segredo in that I'm also hoping to get right by closing night. It's a wild journey every night, and I treasure it. But anyway, we figured out that we actually had met 25 years before he came to my college, to Drake University, with a group from the Royal Shakespeare Company to do a workshop with all of us. I wasn't at it as much as some other kids at that point because I had gotten cast in a local film and was doing that, so I missed a lot of it. But I did do some of it. And so, you know, here we are again 25 years later, and here I am acting on stage with him.
Oh, that's great.
Such a kick, and you know, due to the magic of Facebook, all my old friends who have discovered this are, like, plotzing. oh, my God, he's working with Paul. Some of them, like, I remember one of them said, oh, I proposed to him while he was here. Ask him if he's still available. So that's a particular joy, but... all the people I've worked with, I mean, all three of my directors, I have never been as thrilled to just be around and work with a bunch of people as I have here. The company members, the guest artists, and the grad students are just great, and just like a family.
Yeah, it is. It is. This is a wonderful place to be.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I hope that you have lots of opportunities to do this again and again.
I hope so, too. Believe me, I've already warned them. I want to, if they'll look at me, I want to audition again.
Yeah, I'm sure that they will. Because I haven't seen Galileo yet. Mm-hmm. I'm going to see it day after tomorrow. But I've seen everything else, and you're wonderful.
Wow.
Okay, so now before I let you go, tell me about Rosie Clooney.
Oh, we're happy to. I mean, I've worshipped her since I don't even know when. You know, having lived in New York all those years, I got the good fortune to see her at least once, if not twice a year, because she'd always come to Rainbow and Stars, which was the cabaret room attached to the Rainbow Room, which unfortunately is no more. And my wife Cheryl and I, our first really official date, even though we met in acting class, but our first official date was going to see Rosie Clooney, and many, many times thereafter, and she kind of, you know, brought us together in many ways. Rosie Clooney and Tony Bennett were both of our two favorite people in the world. And then the last time we saw her, well, actually, no, we came back to New York and saw her once or twice after that, but right after we got married and we're going to move away because she'd been headhunted by this company, we were leaving the day after her stint in New York City. We went to see her. We went to both shows. We had befriended the maitre d' there, this amazing fellow who then went on to the Russian Tea Room, who was sort of an institution in New York, and he was so sweet to us. We didn't slap down big bills in front of him, but he always gave us the same table, a great one, after he got to know us, because he just knew how much she meant to us. And we'd sent a note backstage saying, we just got married and we're about to leave New York, and we love your work so much, and you were our first date. Is there any chance you might sing this or this? They're kind of special songs for us, if you take requests. And she didn't say anything the first show, and we stayed for the second one. At the end of the second show, she said, oh, my gosh, I hope they're still here. I got this lovely note backstage from a couple that are moving to Minneapolis. Well, I'll see him next time I have my knees done at the Mayo Clinic. And then as we were leaving, the maitre d' grabbed us and said, you want to meet her? And so he took us backstage, and we met her, and she just... Everybody says this about her. That woman could hug you like you've never been hugged. And we didn't have a camera. But we met her, and she just couldn't have been more lovely. And we always sent her a birthday card after that. And acknowledged one or two of them. And then, unfortunately, she passed away on my birthday. Never forget that. That was like a bolt out of the blue. It just broke my heart. But I know she'd had... struggled with a lot of health issues, but she was, say, one of those guiding presences in my life, just from the work she did, and to get to meet her was just kismet on top of everything else.
And you sing?
Yeah, I used to sing and play in bars and stuff like that, not really sing, but now for the last almost 4 years now, I've been studying seriously with an amazing teacher in Chicago, and she's found this baritone with tenor notes all the way up to an A in me. And so, yeah, I did actually, the grad students do these late night shows. They did one that was all duets in January. And I got to sing with three of the grad students. And I love that. I, you know, I'm such a musical theater geek, but I've only been in a few of them.
But perhaps so this is the beginning.
I'm always available,
right?
Though. Love them, love them.
Okay, so I like to ask... first, if there's anything I didn't ask you that I should have. And second, what, if anything, you have to say about making a life with an art, making a life as an artist.
Well, I wish I could think of something swanky that you could have asked, and I can't.
Well, good. That just means I did my job.
Yeah. And as to the other one, boy, it's tough to say, because everybody's journey is so different in this kind of thing. And I have been so fortunate, because there are some people who are so directed, and I just so was not. I just knew that this is the only thing I do well. I can do other things, but they drive me nuts. And, you know, I've done plenty of table waiting and bartending and, you know, phone banking and, you know, doing improv for lawyer training and you name it. But I also, I bounced around seemingly aimlessly. I wish I had some of the chutzpah and directionality of some of the people I see who know just where they're going. I didn't know where to go, and I didn't know where to find what I needed. But really, when I look back, it found me. I would not have passed up the amazing people that I have studied and am still studying with, who... You know, and here I am at 46, and I've often told myself, damn, I wish I was here by 26. And I really just, in the last couple of years, start to feel like I know how to do this. I know how to approach it anyway, due to the more recent few teachers, wonderful teachers that I've been working with. And but everybody's on their own time calendar, and if it's taken me this long, it's taken me this long. I've been very blessed. I mean, I have managed to find just enough work of other kinds to keep me going, and, you know, now I have a glorious and talented wife who happens to bring in some real green, but it's a struggle, and, you know, I bring in all I can, but it's a pittance compared to hers, and, you know, we're lucky that we are each other's soulmate. Otherwise, she might put a pillow on my head. I guess the only thing I could say is I don't feel like I even persevered. I just kind of went, okay, okay.
You know, I have to tell you that I hear this story over and over. Mm. I know you think there are people who are directioned, but mostly I don't meet them. I must have done 60 of these interviews, and most of the people say the same thing.
Wow.
You know, it came to me, I wasn't looking for it, or it just kept coming at me, over and over again I hear it.
Wow.
It's, I think it's a myth, that thing about, well, maybe it's not a myth, I don't have to go that far. I think in this culture we believe, well, this is a soapbox of mine, so, that we're the Nike culture, you know, that really the way to success or happiness or achievement or anything good is to just do it, to be directional, to know where you're going, and everything that implies. But my personal and professional experience is that that is at least, I want to be really careful about this, I don't want to say that never works.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether it does or not. I know people believe in it. But what is clear to me is that it's not in any way the only thing that works, and that lots of people have your experience, and that it is as though there is a that it's theirs, that it's coming to them, that they are meant. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I agree. It's taken me a long time to start to understand it, but it...
Well, quite often it's retrospect, right?
Yeah.
You know, you look back and you say, oh, yeah, that led to that, and I went there, I didn't mean to, and that person happened to be there, and then that stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, vis-a-vis the what I started with, that everybody's journey is different, but, you know, if I were to say anything, I guess I'd say the things that I've learned and that I wish more people had told me, but I kind of had to learn them on my own anyway, and that is just perseverance, just staying around and keep trying and never stop learning. The moment you don't think it's worth taking another class, reading another book, looking at somebody else's work, or studying with somebody else is the moment you've just frozen yourself.
Right.
And belief. I mean, I wish I had more belief in myself. I had zilcho, which is probably why I was less of a go-getter in the business. But it's gotten me where I am, and I'm never satisfied with what I do. But I, at this point at 46, I can say I can do it. And on a good day, I really like what I've done.
Yeah.
So,
You should feel better about yourself. You're wonderful in everything I have seen.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for taking all this time with me.
My pleasure.
Hi, this is Sharon Leslie with review of The Perfume Shop. Sweet florals, tangy citrus, spicy herbals, and animal musks are the various scents one might attribute to the storyline of The Perfume Shop. This charming play, written in 1937 by Hungarian playwright Miklós László, is getting its first English language production in the United States with a deliciously delightful production at the Oslo Repertory Theater. You may have already seen several versions of this play made into films like The Shop Around the Corner, In the Good Old Summertime, and most recently the loose adaptation, You've Got Mail. But the original is worth seeing. Watching The Perfume Shop made me appreciate the artistry of a good playwright. It's hard to write a romantic comedy with charm, wit, and humanity. This play has differences from the films that are appealing, and the characters come alive as portrayed by the Oslo actors. Foremost is Paul Whitworth as Miklós Hammerschmidt, the perfume shop owner. The character has to go through some fairly tough issues. Whitworth embodies the wide range of emotions that his character goes through with ease and appeal. He makes it easy for us in the audience to identify with Hammerschmidt's problems. Jason Bradley sparkles as the young man who has fallen in love with his girl pen pal, whom he has never met, or so he thinks. Mackenzie Kyle brings passion to her portrayal of the woman he is writing to, but hates in person. Other notables are Ghafir Akbar as the young bicycle delivery boy. He energizes the stage and fills the production with a marvelous sense of comic style. Also, Doug Jones as the passive-aggressive older clerk adds a different dimension to the story aspects with the comings and goings in and out of the perfume shop. The set by Jeffrey Dean is evocative of the 1930s in Eastern Europe, displaying the soft beauty yet functionality of a perfumery. Costumes by Virgil Johnson are gently period and lovely to watch. What I liked the most was the charm and humanity that came through, first with the play, and then with the actors as they brought their characters to life. Like a sweet yet tangy scent, The Perfume Shop should please anyone who goes to see it.
When I interviewed Michael Joseph Mitchell, I had not yet seen Galileo. I saw it last night. It's extraordinary, and I'm so sorry for you that if you haven't seen it, that you won't get to see it, because not only is the play brilliant and compelling, and as Michael said, speaks to those of us who are not right in the conventional wisdom or a little off-center, but the performance, Paul Whitworth's performance, is mind-blowing. What is also mind-blowing, if you see a lot of the plays going on in rep, as I have done at the Oslo, is you get to see these actors doing vastly different roles, sometimes back-to-back. Sometimes they'll do a matinee performance with one show, and then an evening performance with another one, and the next night they'll do the third show. So the four people that I interviewed in this this month, the four actors, it's Chris and Sam, who are in both Searching for Eden and 5 Years After, and Doug, who was in Perfume Shop, and Galileo, and the extraordinary performance in Hearts, which you can still see, and Michael, who was in also in those three plays, playing three vastly different characters, and Jimmy Clark, who I interviewed but you won't hear this month, watching them seemingly effortlessly inhabit three vastly different characters, become three vastly different characters. There's nothing like repertory theater. And the Oslo Repertory Theater is a premier example of that. So again, if you live in or around or near Sarasota, Florida, buy a subscription. Come see everything. If you don't, but you're planning to come to Florida, anywhere in Florida, make it a point to stop here. Sarasota is spectacular, but if you're interested in theater at all, and if you listen to my show, you probably are, put the Oslo on your itinerary. You will not be sorry. Well, okay. Now let me thank yet again, once again, as always, my savior, Josh Hackney, who comes to make sure that these shows sound as good as they can sound, and fixes everything I do wrong, and is there at the other end of the phone when I can't remember things I learned but somehow didn't stick, who knows everything there is to know, and if he doesn't actually know it, he knows how to find it, about electronics, computing, recording, and all the related areas. So thank you to Josh Hackney, and this is, of course, a plug for him. If you need any help with any of those things, you want Josh, and you can go on my website, thelynshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E-S-H-O-W, thelynshow.com, and click on email me and say, I want Josh, and I will get him for you, or click on email me and tell me what you think of the show, or tell me a problem you're having, or pretty much anything. Well, as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that you can use, something that interested you or compelled you, something you knew but had forgotten, something you had never thought of or heard of before, just something that makes you want to come back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and boy, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. My shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get, Gentle into